The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets closed down in a rocky week. Apple estimates are slashed. 10-year Treasury yields hit the highest level since 2014. And we have two guests today, Daniel Crosby of Nocturne Capital and Tim Seymour, CNBC contributor and founder of Triogem Asset Management. All this and much more on episode number 557 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, good day to you. Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz. I'm your host of this great podcast where we come together and discuss all sorts of things financial with some wonderful guests, and we have some great ones lined up for you today. Very pleased that we were able to get such great insights from some great names as we go out there and try to find some good information to help you on your way to financial success, good trading and investing, understanding the market, some education, all those things wrapped up into one. That's what we do here each and every week on this show. Of course, I also host and co-host DH Unplugged with John C. Dvorak. And if you haven't had an opportunity to check that out, you got to do so. We're actually live on Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern. Go over to dhunplugged.com and check that out. Or you could just listen to it on your favorite, at your favorite podcast directory or service or wherever you download your podcast. Let's talk about some of the things that are moving markets, some of the things that happened during the week. We did see that markets ended down after a very promising week. In fact, it looked like there was going to be quite the follow through from the previous week where we saw a nice up week finally after some downside movement of markets, still in this consolidation range. But we did see that there was going to be initially a good reaction that, well, investors were coming back and thinking there was a good amount of optimism. There was less talk and rhetoric about tariffs and things that were going to be concerning for markets. And then kind of got ugly towards the middle part of the week and end of the week where things turned down. A couple of reasons why that was. Clearly, the downgrade of Apple by several firms, cutting estimates, really slashing estimates on iPhone sales. I think that was a big thing that really shook up investors. And we saw that not only from the aspect of, well, what were going to be the deliverables, but also from Taiwan Semiconductor and some other names in the semiconductor space that had actually cut their estimates and reported that they were going to be slowing down on their production. And that obviously spilt over into the area of Apple, which uses a lot of their parts. So that was a big issue. Then, of course, we saw that the 10-year yield started moving. We saw the 10-year yield hit the highest since 2014, closed in at about 2.96, approximately really close to that 3% psychological area. And, you know, why is that? Well, part of that has to do with the fact that there is a lot of inflationary conditions that are starting to show up. We're seeing that in the Philly, for example, I mean, this is a good example, in the Philly Fed release, if you look at the numbers underlying what was involved in the release, there was all sorts of inflationary conditions in terms of wages, in terms of the money that is spent on the manufacturing materials. A lot of things are really starting to look very inflationary in areas that you wouldn't necessarily see. So it's not just the CPI number, just not the PPI number, but underlying a lot of this is a concern. I mean, we saw that aluminum is rallying and we're seeing massive moves in steel. We're seeing lumber prices at all-time highs. These things are definitely inflationary. And as such, you have to expect that the Fed is seeing this also. And what are they going to do? Well, they're going to continue on their rate hike process. And that's probably a good reason why bond yields are continuing to climb. And we'll see what happens here. You know, what is going to happen with some of the numbers in the future? Are we going to see this continuation of the inflationary impact of some of the tariffs and the talk about tariffs and the concern about how we're going to continue to see some of the commodity prices move higher. Is it going to leak over into the traditional area of the core CPI? That's another issue, but it is something that is very concerning. And when you see bonds start to move like this, well, stocks are going to react. Now, remember, it's also earnings season. We have been watching for the commentary from companies during conference calls. It's something we've been talking about a lot. Outlook has been generally good, and that is very promising. However, there's an undertone concern of the impact of geopolitics and tariffs that keeps on coming up. And companies, it appears that companies don't really have to provide some upside over the top. There's definitely high expectations that they're going to beat estimates and revenues are going to come in strong, especially because they have the tailwind of the very weak dollar. But this overriding issue about what is the future going to bring and how are we going to be impacted by inflation or tariffs or the high prices of input products, that's something that companies have really been coming out with and talking about as something that's a concern. And we saw the banks. I mean, these were the first to really report here that they came out and beat pretty much across the board. We saw banks with revenues better. We saw that their earnings are better. And there's a lot of opportunity for them to, well, finagle with the numbers. We know that because banks have the opportunity with so many different business parts to put numbers here, put numbers there, and kind of put things in the footnotes and come out with earnings that may be a little bit better than anticipated. But then when you start breaking it all down and pulling layer by layer off and looking at the actual numbers, it seems that aside from the fact that there was, again, some concern about their outlook, banks are going nowhere. And this is interesting because you really need banks to participate in the upside if markets are going to do well. That's generally the common knowledge of what has to happen in markets. Now, oil's been rallying, which also is not really great for the consumer. Tech is sputtering. We need to get some good earnings next week to keep things going. And of course, we've seen some names do better than others, but that really has to continue on. We've seen some good news related to North Korea. Seems to be a fascinating turn of events here, where North Korea is signaling that they have had enough with the sanctions, I guess. They want to participate maybe in the economic growth they're seeing outside. I think they stepped outside of their country for the Olympics. And they're like, wow, whoa, wait a minute. What's going on here? Look at this incredible amount of wealth. And they said, you know what? We want some of that. That's the way it seems to me. So now they want to possibly denuclearize. They want to come to the table for some kind of discussion. Unless, of course, this is just one gigantic ruse. Maybe coming to the table and seeing that, oh yeah, look, the U.S., they're caving. All we had to do was say we're going to do this and that. Look at these guys. They're weak. Maybe that's going to be the end process of this. I don't know. Next week, we're going to be coming with some big economic news also. We're going to see home sales. We're going to see new and existing home sales come out. And how's that going to be impacted with rates climbing? And also going to be on the watch for the first quarter's advanced GDP that's coming out on Friday, coming off a 2.9% quarter, and estimates for this quarter are only about 2.1%. So that's going to be interesting to try to reconcile how all of a sudden we're seeing a slowdown in quarter over quarter. And if there is a slowdown. Of course, it's also going to be a big week for earnings. We got big tech names that are going to be coming out with earnings. We got Facebook and Microsoft and Google and hundreds of other companies, that key companies actually, that are going to be reporting next week. I'm very, very interested to watch Facebook because with all the news that we've seen and with mixed commentary of whether or not some of the things and their privacy concerns and advertisers, if this is going to actually see some kind of net effect to the revenues that they're bringing in from advertisers. So I do think this is, I don't see how it's possible that over the next few quarters, Facebook will continue to see the massive growth they've seen. It just seems to me that, and it seems logical, that advertisers will be in a more of a wait and see approach, and users will probably be spending less time. Or if not that, plugging up some of their privacy areas. And that may mean less advertising inside of their feeds. So there's a lot of things that really are converging on this whole Facebook. And of course, they're a major component of the NASDAQ. They're a major component of the markets and sentiment. So those are things that you really need to, I think we need to really pay attention to. So a lot of things happening here in terms of the markets. We're going to get to some other or other topics with regard to you know, what's going on with this in the coming weeks, because we really need to pay attention to what's happening with earnings here and how this is all playing out with the tax benefits that we saw, the tax cuts, and how that's all playing out and how it's going to continue, or it's going to just be, you know, a 1 or 2 quarter hit wonder for companies. But clearly we've been in a jumpy situation for markets. No, I mean, everything that comes through the news seems to have a massive reaction one way or another. I was actually commenting earlier in the week that I thought it was really interesting that the VIX has started to come down. Now it's, I don't know, right about 17, but it was about 15 in the beginning of the week, down from that high of 50 that we saw in February. And that was obviously too high. That got ridiculous. That was a momentary panic attack by markets. But now we got back to 15. I'm thinking, wow, you know, I wonder if we're going to be back into an environment that's a little less volatile, where we see that things are going to hold off from reacting very negatively. Maybe the news cycle has slowed down a little bit. Maybe everything that needed to be spit out was spit out during the last couple of months. And we're going to see a little bit less volatility here. And then, of course, we see it pick up again towards the end of the week. So interesting market environment right now. With that, with the idea that, you know, volatility and sentiment is there, I thought we'd bring on a guest who knows this backwards and forwards. Had him on before. So let's get to that discussion and find out what he has to say, because I'm pretty curious about this whole area of the psychology of markets. And today we have on again Daniel Crosby from Nocturne Capital. He's a PhD and author of the wonderful books, The Laws of Wealth, Psychology, and the Secret to Investing Success. Also, You're Not That Great, and soon to be released and available in all fine bookstores, The Behavioral Investor. Daniel Crosby, how are you?
I am awesome. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. So last time you were on was in July of 2016.
Jeez, has it been that long?
Yeah, I think it was 2016. Maybe it was 17. Could have been 17?
I don't know.
Well, anyway, a lot of things have changed over that time, especially in 2018. We've seen kind of a snap change to market sentiment, and that kind of goes into some of the discussion I want to have with you. So first of all, the last book that you put out by yourself is entitled The Laws of Wealth, Psychology, and the Secret of Investing Success. Is there a secret?
There is a secret, and the secret is that there's no secret, right? I mean, the secret is that discipline wins the day, right? And that you are the best predictor of whether or not you're going to reach your financial goals. And I think this year is a great, great depiction of that. You know, Southwest Airlines was up big yesterday after crashing a plane and killing someone. I mean, markets are crazy. And I think the only shot you have at success is managing your discipline.
You know, that's interesting, because you've seen a lot of that, like what happened with Equifax, with a big breach, and then it kind of blew over. And Facebook, when we're seeing, you know, the whole idea that not only are they stealing, or they allowed, or something happened with your data, right, that was available for others to use, and it was pretty prevalent for a long time. But now they're even going so far as fighting the rules that were put in place by the EU and separating out the EU from the user data privacy spectrum. So EU has one rule and they're going to stick to that. But the rest of everybody, they're like, well, the hell with that. We still want to make sure that we can have targeted advertising for the rest of the world. And people forget about things. I mean, is that the nature of people? We just want to forget?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. You see how broad market sentiment sort of colors everything else, right? I mean, when you know, in a March of 2009, when the broad market sentiment's so negative, any little whiff, you know, any little whiff of something being untoward or any little whiff of something being negative, I think gets overreacted to. And then today, you know, when prevailing market sentiment's been positive for so many years now, I think the general tendency is to sweep stuff under the rug. And I mean, I think you've seen that with everything from politics to data breaches to airline crashes. And, you know, it's a very human tendency to project the present into the future indefinitely. You know, people don't sort of account for mean reversion in their own thinking. And I think that Facebook and Southwest and others are the beneficiary of that human bias right now.
So, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because when you think about the environment that we've been in, and I just wonder, you know, some of the things that we've seen on a geopolitical standpoint or company-based, you have to wonder if, as an investor, as a human being, there's a separation there. And I think that's the whole study of behavioral finance, isn't it? Really, you know, the understanding of what, as human beings, we perceive to be the case and what the reality is, and that separation. Is that kind of go into the whole understanding of how to deal with your behaviors and finance?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think it tells you, right? It tells you how you have to separate to the extent possible, and there are limitations, sort of your own prejudices and your own worldview from what's going on in the market. I mean, we've got fully half the country, maybe more than half, if the polls are to be believed, you know, that's very, very pessimistic about the president and has made, you know, market moves accordingly. And it's just a big reminder that you have to separate your personal beliefs, your personal politics, from the way that you operate in financial markets, because they're two separate things, and the market's not always gonna see the world the way that you do.
Yeah, because you could have a beloved president or a beloved Congress, or not even politically, you can have a fantastic outlook for economics. Market could be crashing, in theory. Right. I mean, same thing could happen on the opposite side. You know, I don't think a lot of people think of that. They just think about how, you know, oh, all this negative stuff, I can't believe the markets are up. I mean, there are times, and there will be times, when there's a lot of really positive things out there that maybe markets would be down or a stock would be down. Take, for example, the banks last week. You know, the banks came out with really good earnings. Numbers look good on the top and bottom lines. Outlook was a little bit concerning. They all started up right after their announcement of earnings, and then they fell over pretty hard the next couple of days. So there's that going on, I guess. So in your new book that you have coming out, I think in October, if I'm not mistaken, The Behavioral Investor, what revelations did you have about the subject of investment behavior since we last spoke and since your last book?
Yeah, so this is going to be for my hardcore nerds, right? This new book is going to be for the people who are really, really interested in this stuff. Because what I do in The Behavioral Investor is I look at the societal, the neurological, and the physiological impediments to good investment decision making. So I sort of start with the thesis and, you know, have a rather protracted story to begin the book that talks about how basically society has wired us to follow the crowd and to think in herd terms and not in terms of what's right or wrong, but to think in terms of what's socially acceptable. So then I also talk about how everything from society to your brain to your body conspires to, you know, lead you to make poor financial decisions, and then try and talk about how that manifests itself in behavior and then design systems and processes that are robust to it. So it's ambitious, let's say.
It's ambitious. Okay. Is it going to be hardcover?
Yeah, of course.
I'm just making sure that seals it right there.
Look, I am a book snob. I will not touch a paperback book. And so even though I could sell more by having a paper book, I'm appealing to my fellow snobs. If it's worth reading, it's worth having in hardcover, is my thought.
Yeah. I told you, I still tell you to this day that your last book, the whatever they did on the cover was the most luscious book to touch ever. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe I put him as a pillow. I don't know.
Yeah, they did such a great job with that book. I mean, hopefully the contents were equally desirable, but the outside was just gorgeous on that last book. Yep. So thank you.
So now, going with the crowd, this is a great part of the discussion I think that we should have here. You know, this whole idea that Well, I mean, there's this crowd or groupthink. Penguins. Penguins are a great example, right? If you ever watched a video of penguins that are standing on the edge of an iceberg about to jump off. Everybody waits. They all wait. They all wait. One guy goes. That's it. They're all in. Right? Right. I mean, that's the whole groupthink concept. So you see recently so many analysts and guests on TV and writings, radio, podcasts. I'm talking about the sell side primarily. I'm not talking about us podcasters, which we'll get into your new show in a second, but they're all saying the same thing. It seems as there's no outliers. And I wonder from a, again, from a psychological standpoint, from a groupthink standpoint, is this something to be feeling confident about or concerned?
Yeah. So, for, you know, you spoke earlier about the news, like how there's so much bad news and yet, you know, markets tend to continue to climb this wall of worry. So I'll share a story that I share in the new book, The Behavioral Investor. I was on a, let's call it a prominent 24/7 financial news network recently. And before I went on to said news network, I have the producer in my ear, right? You're wearing an earpiece and you can hear them talking. And as I'm going on, they're kind of counting down. Okay, Dr. Crosby, you're on in 5, 4, 3, 2. And right before they give me the final 2-1, they said, give us something juicy. Don't be a nerd.
Right? Oh, there you go.
And so this to me is like such a great sort of inside baseball, behind the scenes look at how the sausage gets made. You know, you get someone like me who's an academic who has, you know, a vested interest in being nuanced and scientific. And they're saying, you know, don't be a geek, man. Like, give us something good. They didn't say be truthful and nuanced and scientific. They said, don't be a nerd. And so remember that story the next time you're hearing some catastrophic doom and gloom news story, that's how the sausage gets made.
Yep.
So in terms of the herd mentality, it's fascinating to me because I talk about in the book, I talk about research that was done by the guy that wrote Sapiens. If you have not read that book, I can't recommend it enough to your listeners. But the book Sapiens is all about sort of human development, you know, the development of Homo sapiens over the last 200 something thousand years. And he talks in there about how we are wired to believe in communal fictions. So we believe in things like, you know, the Constitution or the state of Alabama or the Catholic Church or whatever you want to say, all of these things are man-made institutions. And our belief in these communal fictions is what allows us to build great societies. It's absolutely the best thing that we have going. And money, he says, is the greatest of these communal fictions of all. Like, money's something we all believe in, we all work for, but it's only as good as our belief in it, right? So from a very, very fundamental level, we are wired to reason, not in terms of whether or not something is true, but whether or not it's socially acceptable. And while that belief in shared fictions allows us to build great civilizations and religions and states, right? Mm-hmm. It also can be our downfall in markets because we are absolutely wired to believe what other people believe. So, you know, this group narrative that emerges in the news is partially born out of human nature and partially born out of a desire for clicks and eyeballs.
You know who writes a lot about this is, you know, Ben Hunt, Epsilon Theory.
Oh, yes, I do.
I mean, he writes a lot about this. He recently wrote about something called the nudging state. And he talks about how the idea is that, well, you really need to be aware of the fact that there is an eye in the sky, if you will. You know, there's some concerted effort by them, whoever they are, them, okay, that are trying to sway people's behavior by slow and steady nudges to do a specific action. So, for example, he used the Fed. So the Fed says, well, you know, economics are good and times are good and we're going to do this way and slowly. And they kind of adjust their numbers and their conversation to push people to do a certain thing, which is kind of like one more step beyond the groupthink that I want to do that. But it's okay. I want to at least play the game. You know, don't fight the Fed. I want to stay with the idea that, okay, this must be what everybody's doing. This must be what is right to do. Therefore, I believe it's right also. You know,
yeah.
And so, and you know, the truth is that here's what I always say. If there's 100 people in a room, you're in the room, 99 other people, and you look at all the other people and their opinion is something and yours is different, you're wrong. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way it goes, I think, right? So, Let's kind of back up for a second. I know you have a new podcast out too, huh? Hopefully I inspired you after the show you were on that you said, oh, I gotta do that.
You absolutely did.
I was the one, right? Yeah, I was the one.
You were the one. Yeah. You were absolutely it. So yeah, I have a podcast. I have a podcast called Money, Mind, and Meaning that allows me to talk about all my favorite things, right? So the first season, which we're just about wrapping up, it's going to be about 30 episodes that are all didactic, right? They're just lessons in behavioral finance. It's just me talking about behavioral finance. Season two, I'm going to get smart people like you on and interview them because that's where I want to go next.
Cool.
So yeah, look.
Now, hopefully, so you mentioned that this thing about seasons and episodes. I mean, I'm from old school. We just kind of just started ticking off the episode number. You know, we kind of just went on from there. But now there's a new thing, and hopefully you're not going to do this. Please tell me you're not going to do this, that there's people starting to call this, well, I've seen a couple of people. It's not a podcast. It's a pod. Is this a thing we're going to have to deal with?
You know what? I've got a cop to having done that once to stay within Twitter's character limit.
Oh.
And it's right. Hey, look, it's annoying. And I want to apologize to you first and foremost right here on the show.
I'm so insulted. No, but I think if you could just shorten it down, call it a cast. Don't call it a pod, right? I mean, if it makes more sense to call it a cast.
Apostrophe cast from now on.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm team cast from now on.
There you go. You also have a recent video series I thought was really cool. I don't know, there's 8 or 9 of these, but one of them, we're going to put a link actually in the show notes for episode number 557 of where these can be located. But one of them that was really interesting, and you start off with the first concept that you wanted people to understand was that we must invest in risk assets to survive. That's concept one. Number two, we are psychologically ill-equipped to invest in risk assets, which then therefore blows out number one. So can you kind of go over that and explain what you're talking about there?
Yeah, it's this. So the name of the series is On Your Best Behavior. It's done through Investment News, and there's actually going to be over 40 of them.
Wow.
So they're going to be coming. Yeah, trust me. Trust me, I filmed them all. It was wow to film them all.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's coming out. But this is the great paradox, right? So we have to invest if we are to maintain even a decent standard of living, unless we're just enormously wealthy, just given the corrosive power of inflation, right? And how purchasing power is eroded enormously over time. So that's one sort of reality. The second reality is, as I like to say, God could not have created a worse investor than you or I. Mm-hmm. Like every impulse we have is backwards. And I talk in the Laws of Wealth about Wall Street bizarro world, about how so many of the realities of investing are exactly contrary to the realities of our everyday. Like, you know, in our everyday, we're very sure of what's going to happen in 5 minutes. We have no idea what's going to happen in 5 years. You know, investing is nearly flipped in that respect. In everyday, doing more gets us more. You know, if we want to get smarter, we read more books. If we want to get stronger, we lift more weights. In investing, across the 19 different countries that we looked at, the more people trade, the worse they tend to do. So there's all of these sort of things that seem rational or adaptive in our everyday life that just don't apply to the science of investing. And then you've got all the stuff that I'm writing about in The Behavioral Investor, which is, you know, your brain is against you, your body is against you, society is against you. It's not, that sounds more pessimistic than it is, but I think we need to be aware of what stands in our way if we're going to make rational and decisions.
Yeah. So, you know, I was just thinking, just a side note here, as you were talking about this and the idea that maybe some people who, it's interesting how you find newbies that are investors, they do really well. And you're like, well, what did you do? Well, I invested 1,000 shares in this and I made, you know, $2. I'm like, you invested in what? What is that? I never heard of that company before. You know, some crazy company that was moving and all that. And they do well for a while, but it's kind of like the whole crypto fad that was on for a while, kind of off for a while, maybe back on again. But I think it's really interesting from a psychological standpoint. I got to believe that you are looking at this as a great study in the whole area of investing because you went from nothing to boom to bust in such a short period of time.
Yeah. So one of my favorite sort of market truisms is that I like to say is that you can be right and still be a moron, yeah, right? So yeah, you can have the right result and have achieved it for such moronic reasons that over a lifetime of investing, you're likely to still get bit and you're still likely to end up on the bottom. And so everything I talk about in all of my books is about trying to systematize good behavior and trying to be the house, right? Like trying to be the casino instead of the drunk guy at the, you know, at the blackjack table. Mm-hmm. And so there are plenty of people. I was at a dinner party when, right, like right around Thanksgiving, when it felt like everyone at the table was getting rich on crypto.
Yep.
But me, right?
Right.
Because I never touched it. And so, yeah, it was fascinating though. And you know, another thing that candidly I observed in myself, and if I observed it myself and I know better, how much more did it impact other people? At first, when I first heard of cryptocurrency, I was enormously skeptical and I just thought it was, you know, sort of silly. But then the price started to change my mind. Mm-hmm. And then when the price gets to 20,000 bucks, you're yep. thinking, geez,
yep.
maybe I was wrong.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how price drives narrative. And I think we have to be careful to disconnect those things.
And it's interesting because just the final point on this is that there's a lot of people that I follow on Twitter. There's a couple of snarky technical analyst charting guys. I'm sure you know them. You know, kind of always saying, oh, this doesn't look like a downtrend, does it? You know, and kind of always trying to push you and, you know, why is anybody bearish on this or anything, you know? And talking about how news and headlines and information doesn't matter, doesn't mean anything, should be avoided entirely and just look at the price, which, okay, I get that from a chart standpoint. Some even say that economic reports, the Fed speak, they don't really impact markets, that markets do what markets do. Is that true?
Yeah, so I have in my old age, right? So I really began my journey as an investor as sort of a dyed-in-the-wool value guy. And I have gotten more respect for, you know, for things like charting, things like technical analysis and momentum, trend following strategies as time has gone on. I think there's a really dynamic interplay between the two things. And I've had a lot of success in my own trading, my own investing, melding those two things together.
Yeah.
Like when I've tried to come up with defensive strategies, I can tell you that the most catastrophic losses occur when you have a combination of steep valuations as measured from a fundamental level, and then flagging sentiment or flagging momentum as measured by technical analysis. So those two things, I think, are what you need to look out for as like sort of look out below signals. And I would defy anyone to tell me that we don't look at stretched valuations today from a sort of a fundamental level. I mean, everything that, at least in the US, right? Everything that I look at from a fundamental level says things are stretched. Well, combining that with technical indicators, I think can be a powerful 1-2. But I think it's overly optimistic and a little bit silly to say that the market is either all rational or all technical. And I think that the further we can sort of decamp from those sort of Republican and Democrat sort of artificial distinctions, I think the better off we'll be.
Yeah, that's a great, great ending to this discussion. Daniel Crosby, we'll make sure to have all the information on the show notes for episode 557. We'll look forward to having you again soon.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right, buddy. Be well. Have a good day. Well, the psychology of money, I mean, that's a big issue, right? With regard to how people think about things and how they move. We talked about this whole idea of herd mentality. And I thought I'd bring up the idea of what's going on in the crypto space. If you haven't seen, I mean, right now we're seeing a massive move once again after just some lull time, kind of sleep time, kind of go to sleep and it looks like it's not going anywhere time for the cryptos. It's a good amount of talk that there was this whole idea that, you know, what's keeping down the prices are all the selling that's going on because of taxes, because of major tax bills with the value of Bitcoin moving up is starting to hit, and there's all this selling going on because all these people are paying taxes. I don't know, but it seemed rather illogical to me because a lot of the markets don't send out any kind of 1099s, and people probably that are involved in crypto are, well, they're not so apt to put that on their taxes. But well, lo and behold, tax time came just right on the heels of that, or just right into that. All of a sudden, the crypto started moving. In fact, Bitcoin nearing 9,000 from about, it was about 6,500 or so a week ago. Ethereum was moving from the levels about 400 recently to 630 over the weekend. Bitcoin Cash is rocking. Moved from 600 to 1,200 in the last 2 weeks. 2 weeks. Just when you thought things weren't going to play out anymore, we're seeing this massive rallying again. Plus, the altcoins are seeing major moves. So you look at this and you say, wow, what's going on there? So is it really tax selling relief, this bounce that's going on right now, or is it something else? Probably when we just talked about the whole groupthink and herd mentality and, well, the penguins, of course, the penguin discussion with Daniel Crosby just a moment ago, you got to think that psychology has something to do with it. And people are like, well, it's starting to move again. I got to get back on that trend, you know, train again. I got to get back into that. And I don't want to miss out. You know, the FOMO is hitting up really high because with this crypto stuff, things move very quickly and people do not want to be caught on the sidelines. So we're starting to see a lot of that movement again. So it's kind of interesting to watch that and to watch what's going on with that. I don't see any other structural issues that have changed. A couple of companies have bought and we've seen some news about some major players saying, yeah, they're getting into the space. But I don't, again, it didn't really coincide with the move. It really, while it did move after tax season, yes, it was still pretty dramatically starting to move a little bit before that. I just don't buy into this whole tax selling concept. With that, let's get to the area of emerging markets. We have two guests today, as I mentioned, so let's get to right to our next guest. I have some questions that I've been wondering about for a while, and I need to get to him to answer these because he's the guy that knows all about the area of emerging markets, or as we call it, EM. And our next guest is Tim Seymour. He's the co-founder and managing partner at Triogem Asset Management, which is a hedge fund and wealth management firm that he formed back in 2008. And he's a regular, and I think one of the original Fast Money traders. Is that right on CNBC? Are the original?
I'll take that moniker. Actually, I would call myself the original sixth man. So they started the show back in 2006, and they had four very talented guys on the floor, and asked me to be the guy to come in off the bench when someone needed to be spelled, and the rest is history, as we say.
Yeah, plus an amazing drummer, by the way, just to let everybody know that. Multi-talented.
Well, I'm not sure. Amazing is... in the musical world, a wide spectrum. I've been playing a long time. I love music. So yeah. Thank you for bringing that up.
Well, compared to me, you're amazing. Let's put it that way.
All right.
Let's talk about the business strategy that you do for your firm. I know you're, kind of all about, and last time we talked was many years ago, but, EM, emerging markets, and you do a lot of work in that area. It seems that everybody's favorite idea this year is emerging markets. Every time I talk to a mutual fund manager, I talk to, an institutional guy, EM and international, is that kind of still what you're thinking as well?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, I've spent a lot of time looking at global markets. I started out trading G24 debt at UBS out of business school. G24 as a term barely exists anymore, but that, effectively was the high grade developed markets, sovereign debt. So it gives you it requires a real important orientation on global macro, FX, policy, et cetera, et cetera. So, and from there, I went into the emerging market world and went real deep in with a role as a partner in a Russian investment bank for 7 years. And this was at the time that emerging was really starting to catch wind and silver commodities. And obviously, all of that is a very cyclical, higher risk, higher volatility, asset allocation call, which isn't for everybody. And, through all that, though, have been investing in obviously global equity markets, which include the U.S., which include Japan and Europe. And I think, looking at the world today, the reason why the mutual funds that you're talking to are pretty fired up about emerging is because, and you've worked through a lot of the painful elements of what came out of the crisis and the essentially fiscal readjustments in all of these places, whether it's Brazil or China or, the dynamics that obviously made these places really exciting for a long time. Then they got crushed with the rest of the world, and because EM is a higher risk investment, it took some time also to work through some of the credit excesses of the rest of the world, which actually disproportionately hit emerging markets. But anyway, so where have we gone in the last 18 months is that as the world has kind of gone through this now overused term of, you know, kind of synchronized global growth, emerging markets are really back in a place where global GDP is their best friend. And this is still, you know, these are countries that largely are still, you know, countries that are very capital dependent. And also terms of trade are very important. And those things have improved dramatically. In many cases, you've got currencies that are pretty cheap relative to where they were, in some cases, phenomenally cheap. And as I say, these are countries that now are actually sit differently from a gearing perspective. So, yeah, I think emerging is interesting. I don't think valuations are universally cheap. And I think if we're going to see global markets pull back, and I'll leave that to you guys to discuss, you know, emerging's not going to do well. Emerging's not going to outperform dramatically. Emerging will outperform in sideways upwards markets here. And I think on a stock by stock or country by country basis, there's, you know, those that will do more or less. But I think, you know, and so what we do is we run a global equity strategy, which is you can either hedge it or it's a long product. And, you know, we're attempting to kind of go anywhere, best opportunities. In some cases, we really care a lot about value. In some cases, we are more focused on sectors where growth is the bigger component. And so therefore we're looking at companies on a relative value to their peers, et cetera. So, you know, it's an interesting time right now, because you know, clearly I think, as we wrestle with the broader kind of input risks of higher interest rates, higher inflation, higher, you know, potentially trade tension, higher, you know, just yielding to global volatility, it's probably creating great opportunities, because I think people that are looking at those sectors and those investments that are not the S&P and are not kind of defensive type allocations, this isn't going to be for the weak of heart, but it's going to be about picking either managers or sectors, companies, themes, et cetera, that you really know well, really feel comfortable and don't believe that some of these forces are going to change all that much the underlying investment objective. So that's a long answer to what we do and kind of why those markets and what's going on.
So, you know, one of the things that I've noticed, I think, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I tune into the show. As a matter of fact, probably the only thing I watch on business finance TV. And am I wrong about that lately you've been kind of pushing back on the other gang that sits to your, I guess, to your left about, you know, some valuations? I think I've heard you kind of like, you know, say many times, like, what are you talking about when some people are bringing up some of these ideas of and right. how they've changed kind of tune. Some of the folks on the show have changed their tune from being always short to all of a sudden liking like a Tesla.
Right. Well, it's we're very appreciative of the viewership we have, and you know, it's nice to hear that it's a show that you watch in a very competitive world of financial TV. And you know, one of the things that makes Fast Money great is it is a, you know, hopefully a pretty healthy discussion amongst not always aligned views, and at the same time trying not to you know, make it, you know, all too you're trying to simplify a lot of concepts mm-hmm. for a lot of people right. that also may not be market professionals, and then also people that are market professionals. So you know, my views of late, and I try to really, you know, the most important thing we can do on TV is be consistent. In my view, and non-sensational, and so if you see me change my tune from last night, I better have explained why, mm-hmm. Rather than just suddenly believing something different or saying something different. Now there are times I'll try to play devil's advocate or be oppositional for the sake of a good debate, and that's again the core of our show. But you know, my view since call it January 26th, but definitely since February 2nd, was that a few things have changed. You know, I felt for a long time that off the kind of the lows of the first quarter of 2016, that we really had found a bottoming in commodities. We had found you know, we'd overcome the sense of global recessionary fears. And I don't want to get too deep back into 2 years ago, but it sets the table for where we went and now where we are. People were very offsides on China. They were very offsides on global growth. There were a ton of people that were calling for a recession. There was a whole lot of concern about just, you know, the recovery and what the Fed was able to engineer. And so, as we all remember, really, the Fed's first rate hike, you know, ultimately led to this disastrous response in markets. Once people started to kind of catch the reality of they may have hiked too fast. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out, you know, they probably were right to do it. Not only were they right to do it, they probably should have done a little more faster along the road. But we went into this period of after going through a terrible, terrible bottoming process in the first quarter of 2016. The reality that we weren't going into a recession, that was an overreaction. China wasn't going to blow up, and that actually, you know, we were seeing this real strong reflation trade, and that reflation trade has carried all the way through. And I still think, you know, at the core of the reflation trade is that there are pricing pressures, and that's a good thing, that there is inflation. And so, you know, that's kind of what took us, you know, I think higher and where hopefully we're struggling today with the concept of interest rates is because actually there is inflation. Inflation is not always a bad thing, and a growth scare is worse than an inflation scare anytime. Mm-hmm. And that's where we were. But where we got to on February 2nd was we finally got, you know, really some signs that the Fed was going to move faster. And we got those signs because the wage component of the payroll number that was announced that day were very hot. And they, you know, that jived with what's been, I think, price inputs and measurements in a number of the other either surveys, you know, data points, macro releases that we have that measure price inputs. And so the Fed is accordingly come in. There's no question to me, equities are going to be a beneficiary of a world where volatility sits at 10 or 11 or 9 or wherever we largely were trading within over an 18-month band. And largely, really, you know, there's of course been some vol spikes in the last 10 years, but really since 2009 when central banks decided they were going to control, you know, global volatility in the form of monetary policy. So, you know, there's two things that have been for me the pushback. Equities in a 20 vol environment are worth very, you know, very different what they are worth in a 10 vol environment. I don't care what anybody says. It's about risk reward, standard deviation, volatility. This is how you value securities. Those with less volatility are at least all other things being equal are worth more. Obviously there are many other things that would not be equal. The other really important dynamic here is the world doesn't end at a 3% 10-year, but equities are priced differently at a 3% 10-year than they are at a 2% 10-year. It's just, that's a fundamental fact of doing equity modeling and just understanding also the realities of where you start to see allocation changes between, you know, crossover guys and I mean, you know, the big pension funds of the world, for example, with a 3% 10-year, are investing differently on the edges, at least, than they are at a 2% 10-year.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, the thing is, it's very simple, right? Simple math. When you do a valuation process on a company and you use a risk-free rate of return and you look at the valuation multiples on a risk-free rate of return on just a straight valuation, if you have a very low risk-free rate of return, it obviously creates a better, higher potential for valuation. And if you have a higher risk-free, then the offset is it changes the whole dynamic, which is what you just said, the dynamic of the valuation of the thing. But I think it's really kind of interesting how so many players are out there talking about, you know, the whole don't fight the Fed we know about, which is, you know, if the Fed is going one direction, well, just don't fight them. But yet when the Fed goes the other direction, that whole thesis, just like the discussion of constant currency, we don't hear about anymore because it's a tailwind now. Right. You know, once it's a tailwind and things change, the whole thesis changes for a lot of people. So I'm glad that you mentioned that there is definitely some valuation that needs to be looked at when there is a change that is that fundamental. Quickly on a couple of quick things, really. Did it also change? Did you also have a little bit of change on this whole change in the dynamic of the conversation about really America first and the whole tariff discussion?
So I'm not sure what, you know, what was, what's being put out there as what my view was. But on the tariff discussions, I have, here are my views. I think that there's no question that the United States should continue to cut the best deals it can. The United States, in some cases, probably has seen some erosion in their competitiveness in certain markets, and which has been a very overt, intentional action by, you know, some foreign trading partner. And I think, you know, we always need to cut better deals. Tariffs, blanket trade tariffs don't work, in my view. And I think the, you know, disincentivizing global trade is a bad idea. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the headlines are painful. The reality of what ultimately takes place, we'll see how differently it goes. You know, the steel industry, defending the steel industry on national security concerns, I think, is laughable. But, you know, I do think that there's no question that we want to make sure that no one is dumping steel on our borders or doing it through third parties. So, you know, my view on kind of all of the how this has played out is I don't have any problem with us attacking China on intellectual property, or, you know, maybe attacking is the wrong word. But the dialogue and the discussion and the policy needs to continue to understand that China has stolen U.S. intellectual property repeatedly over the years. And there's nothing wrong with targeting that as a problem. Trying to have manufacturing parity or a taking the deficit on China on a manufacturing level to even or even something, you know, that was $100 billion in deficit would be totally missing the point. We are not a manufacturing economy in this country anymore. China is still a manufacturing.
And we don't want to be. We don't want to be, do we?
We don't want to be. I mean, so this is the stuff that, you know, I just think is the wrong conversation. And when we're looking at China having a huge, you know, manufacturing, trade surplus to the United States, you know what? They're supposed to. And that's, you know, based upon the skill of our labor versus the skill of their labor. And all those other things that we can say for another class. But that's kind of how I feel about trade.
Right. All right, I appreciate that. Lots of good information. You can always contact him. We'll put your contact information, how to get over to your company and find out more information over on the show notes episode. And also, of course, 5 p.m. on CNBC, Fast Money Show, and then throughout the day as well. So, hey, appreciate it. We'll talk again soon.
It's a pleasure to be here, and let's not wait so long for the next one.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you. Thanks.
Talk to you soon. Right, bye-bye.
Tim knows a lot about emerging markets. I got to tell you something. He really has a depth of resources available, and always great talking to him. It's been too long. It really has been too long. Been a number of years since we spent time on the show talking, but I think he's been on two or three times before. So I really enjoy spending time talking to him. Also mentioned just really quickly the Benzinga FinTech Awards. If you haven't checked those out and you want to attend, I'll be in New York. I think Tim will be there as well. But I'll be in New York. It's I think it's the 15th, 16th. So you go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. On the right side, you'll see a little bit of a little banner there. Check it out. Just see what's going on. Look at all the speakers. Really fascinating lineup of the area of fintech or financial technology. And there's an awards going on, but just the insight and information that you can glean from a lot of these speakers and the conversations and the panels that will be going on there, going to be really, really cool. So if you're in the area or you want to get into the whole and find out more information about like what's going on with fintech and where are some of the areas I can make some money with this and how can I really optimize what I'm doing and, you know, with my trading platforms or whether it's going to be some of the new things that will be coming out in the future, this is the place to get the information. So check that out over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks a lot for joining me today. Make sure to do me a favor, send the tweet out on the show, retweet it. often as you can. Send it to your friends on Facebook or LinkedIn or wherever else that you're looking at it. And I really appreciate you spending the time with me. We have some great guests coming up next week as well. So stick around, stay tuned for that. Otherwise, have a great weekend, have a great week. I'll see you again then. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.